this afternoon I'd like to reflect on some of the ways that the Buddha spoke about self, some of the dimensions of anatta, of non-self. So the Buddha was very clear in his teaching in saying that all conditioned phenomena are dukkha, innately unable to provide lasting happiness and freedom. He said that all conditioned phenomena are anicca, that the ripples of ever-present change and instability run through all events, all experiences, all lives, all people. And he went on to say that all conditioned phenomena are anatta, empty of self, without any eternal centralized self, empty of independent self-existence. Now the teaching of anatta, or non-self, and the teaching of shunya, sometimes translated as shunyata, or emptiness, probably the most radical of all of the Buddha's teachings. We bear in mind that the Buddha lived in a time where all around him people were engaged in heroic and endless quests to secure a present and a future self through rituals, through identities, through roles, through the accumulation of merit, through sacrifices. And the invitation to investigate the whole notion of a self central to all experience and present in all things was in that time radical. It was a challenging of a worldview, and it was a challenging of a personal view. Now, in our times and in our world, I feel that we engage in not so dissimilar pursuits. We rely upon possessions for self-definition. We seek for identities, for roles, for relationships, to try to secure a present, unassailable self. And perhaps deep in our hearts, we find ourselves hoping for and longing for a continuity of me. I came across someone not long ago wearing a t-shirt, and the motto on the t-shirt said, "Actually, it is all about me." And I thought, finally, someone's got the honesty to actually say it and advertise it and wear it, you know. And so I often think it's helpful to look at what are our own emotional responses to the proposal that the sense of I, the solidity of me, may be no more than a view, something of an illusion, like a mirage in a desert, or the illusion that because we can see the sun rise in one direction and go over the horizon over there, it seems logical to assume that the sun is circling the earth. Just as it seems in some way logical to assume that the world is circling around me. So what is our response to the possibility that actually it's not all about me? It's actually not all about me. That our bodies, our emotions, our perceptions, our intentions, our mind, that all of our experiences of the moment are not mine. That they don't belong to me. That they're not who I am. What is our response to that? Do we find ourselves feeling dismissive, say, hearing that small voice inwardly saying, "Of course I am. I think, therefore, I am. My life, my stories, all of this is who I am." Do we find ourselves in the light of the proposal of non-self of feeling somewhat disturbed or even fearful? You know? What would give my life meaning? What would get me out of bed in the morning? Look at all I have done. Look at all that I wish to do. Do we find ourselves feeling agitated? Well, what about all my, you know, my importance? You know, my specialness? My me? What about my hopes, my dreams, my longing, my individuality? Or sometimes do we hear the proposal that it isn't actually all about me as really rather good news? Because you've probably noticed it's really hard work to be a self. You know, you have to keep asserting, you have to keep defending, you have to keep proving, you have to keep advertising, you have to keep proclaiming, you have to keep reinventing. It is hard work. Sometimes we get weary of our stories of me. But there's a certain tension, isn't there? Because the sense of self is a very felt experience. And there's nowhere that the Buddha is encouraging us to somehow annihilate that felt experience. It's one of the primary reasons why I think the whole possibility of non-self feels so, in a way, so impalatable or so implausible, because this is who we feel to be. It's like we wake up in the morning and we're there, aren't we? We're there. It's kind of like an old pair of comfortable slippers waiting beside the bed, and we just slip into ourselves, don't we? We just slip into ourselves and my day and my projects and, you know, my relationships and my hopes. And in some ways, this is good news, and it's because that is a felt sense. It's why the Buddha never actually promoted no self, which would make us dysfunctional. And if you notice, you know, my impression is the Buddha and those around him were pretty functional people. You know, they actually managed to get through life really quite well. You know, and it's a good sense. We will always have a navigational sense of self. And I think that's the simplest way of putting it. It's a navigational sense of self that has been born of our life experience, that has a certain intelligence, a certain knowing. But a navigational sense of self is a very, very different creature than a constructed self born of identification. So it's very important to make that distinction. A navigational self is very helpful. It means that you know your address. You know what bed to get into. You know where to go to work. You know, you remember your telephone number. You know, all of these things. You know, you remember how to cook. You don't have to kind of relearn this every day. You know, this is part of a navigational sense of self, is it helps us to move through this life in a reasonable and an intelligent way. Instead, the Buddha taught non-self, that no thing has an independent self-existence. And he taught the way to bring clinging to a view of self to an end. And the Buddha described the clinging to a view of self as an illness, an affliction, an irritation, a construction, a vexation, a sankhara, a pattern, a habit. And he proposed, actually, that the majority of the difficulties that we experience in this life, the majority of our fears, our struggles, our conflicts, our psychological and our emotional suffering, stem from the reification of a self. Centralizing the view of self. And he proposed that the profound release of that view brings clinging to an end and actually opens the door to a very profound peace and freedom that brings all suffering and all conflict to an end. He said that releasing the clinging to a view of self is what allows all of the Brahmaviharas of kindness, of compassion, of joy and equanimity to really flourish and come to fruition, and an unshakable freedom. Describes this as unbinding the heart. Unbinding the heart from wrong view. And there's a verse I want to read you, which is really so central to this from the text. The Buddha says, "Through many lives I sought in vain the builder of this house of pain. Now, builder, thee I plainly see, this is the last abode for me. The gable's yoke and rafters broken, my heart has peace." In contemporary neuroscience, of course, you know, non-self is not particularly a Buddhist view, by the way, just to get that clear. You know, in contemporary neuroscience, contemporary psychology, you know, people spend their whole lives trying to pin down a self without success. Paul Brooks, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, Into the Silent Land. He's a neuropsychologist who spent his whole life kind of studying, you know, where trying to find where the self lives, you know, without success, which he completely acknowledges. And he speaks about, you know, observing patients who've gone through major trauma and how it's affected their sense of self. And he says, we swallow the illusion of unity to imagine in the first place that there is a whole thing, a whole self. From a neuroscience perspective, we are all divided and discontinuous. The mental processes underlying our sense of self, feelings, thoughts, memories, are scattered through different zones of the brain. There's no special point of convergence, no cockpit of the soul, no soul pilot. They come together in a work of fiction. A human being is a storytelling machine. The self is a story. This is not to say that our lives are fictions. Unlike Robinson Crusoe or Emma Bovary, we are embedded in a universe with physical and moral dimensions, where every thought and action splinters into a million consequences. But then we ask, who tells the story of the self? That's like asking, who thunders the thunder, or who rains the rain? It's not so much a question of us telling the story as the story telling us. The story telling us who we are. There is a tendency on retreats, and I think a little bit in the context of practice in the Western world, to almost kind of rarefy the whole teaching of non-self. You know, on retreats it's often reserved for the last evening's talk. You know, that we've kind of built ourselves up to hearing this very special, you know, very special teaching, you know. Somehow reserved for old students, as if this is so complex, you know, that it's not likely to be understood by the ordinary person. And, you know, there's some element of some basis for this, some element of truth to this, because I do think that for us to undertake a meaningful investigation into anything actually requires supportive conditions. Requires some depth of calm, some depth of mindfulness, some curiosity and stillness. And when we hear the words anatta, or we hear the word shunyata, non-self, or emptiness, voidness, Have you read the discourse? The greater discourse on voidness. There's a lesser one too. But they all sound like big words, don't they? They sound like very weighty words. You know, almost like we have to gird ourselves for this. But it's also important to acknowledge that the Buddha did not reserve this teaching on emptiness and non-self for graduate students. This was his early teaching. You know, people would just roll up off the street and he would talk about non-self and emptiness. And I think this is a very real reason that we should definitely not feel intimidated by the words. But, you know, the Buddha sought for graduates. The Buddha sought for people who would actually come to the same insights, the same understandings that he understood and that he saw. And these are understandings, I think, that are truly accessible to us all. And what is offered by these understandings is accessible to us all in terms of inner freedom. And I would suggest that, in truth, everything that we do in this practice and that everything that we undertake on this path is dedicated to the process of emptying all events and all experiences of selfing. That we're in the process of emptying the moment of selfing. The process of emptying all things of reification and clinging. And engaging in this practice of emptying can only ever be a present moment cultivation. It's not a concept. This is very much an applied understanding. Now, personally, I really love the metaphor of the house builder. Because it's a very visual metaphor, isn't it? You know, you gather together all your tools, you gather together all your materials, you know, and you hammer them all together, you know, and you nail them all together, and pretty soon you've got a structure. And it's a structure that's built. And if you just rolled up off the street, you know, and saw that structure and without the building process, it looks really solid, doesn't it? It looks really solid, like it's always been there. It looks very reified, as if it's always existed in that form. But house building is the ways, you know, if you take that metaphor into your own experience, it's the ways that we seek to establish an abode, establish an identity, and establish a center. Again, through assembling all of these materials, hammering them together until it looks like something that we want to live in. The difficulty, of course, with this is that at times we do find ourselves nailing together a structure that we don't actually want to live in, and we feel stuck there. Now, what is the primary mechanism that we use to create those structures, to create those abodes? And bear in mind that these abodes are kind of being constructed, you know, many times in a single day, although some of them are much more historical. The primary mechanism that we use to construct these abodes is the mechanism of identification. It's the mechanism of clinging to create the abode that says, I am, this is me, this belongs to me. I think that this process of house building, of course, is something that we can trace and that we can track in our own experience if we look very carefully. I wonder if any of you have ever had this experience. I have it quite often when I'm somewhat disoriented by jet lag and I wake up somewhere and I have no idea where I am. You might have had that experience. I have absolutely no idea where I am. And I used to kind of be a bit disturbed by those experiences. Now I quite welcome them. But I have no idea where I am. And I notice when I have no idea where I am, actually my idea of who I am is quite sketchy. You know, like I'm not quite sure what I'm doing there, what I'm supposed to be doing, you know, what my day is going. You know, I think, why am I here? You know. But then I notice that, you know, how the world starts to get constructed. And it's generally through perception. You know, I start to recognize the color of the curtains, you know, and that hotel chain always has that furniture, you know, and I start to hear certain sounds. And then I start to notice that my world is starting to get built. And as my world gets built, you know, there I am. There I am. I know exactly what I'm doing. You know, I know exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. I have a reason to get out of bed. But it's a kind of a suspension of familiarity. It's a sort of suspension of certainty for just a few moments. Now, that process, that suspension of familiarity or suspension of certainty, this actually can be quite benign. It can be quite neutral, or that construction, that beginning to construct my abode, can actually be surrounded and founded upon clinging. It all depends on our understanding in that moment. Now, the Buddha speaks of self, the idea of self, actually in three different ways. The first of these ways is called, in Pali, Sukhaya Ditti, or personality view. My personality view, my self view. The second way that the Buddha speaks about the idea of self in Pali is called Mana. And this is awkwardly translated as the conceit of self, which I will explain more. But it's the ways that I position myself self-referentially in relationship to others. Okay. And the third of these is called shunya or shunyata or emptiness. That it's not only impossible to find an abiding, independent self-existence within this structure, that it's also not possible to find an abiding, independent self-existence in anything, in any form. That all forms, all formations are empty of self. There's much in the kind of Mahayana tradition that speaks of that. Shantideva puts it, he says, "You must surely know emptiness is a perfect grass. This emptiness is bound to bloom like hundreds of grasses blossoming. Seeing a dazzling variety of the flowers of emptiness, we surmise an infinity of the fruits of emptiness. We observe the bloom and the fall of the flowers of emptiness and learn the spring and the autumn of them." Now, for the purposes of this afternoon's contemplation, I'd primarily like to focus on these first two dimensions, these first two views of self. Sukhaya Ditti, personality view, and Mana, or the conceit of self. Since, I think it's a logical follow-on, that the understanding of emptiness or shunyata is the natural outcome of understanding the illusory nature of both personality view and mana. Now, personality view is I think, you know, the reason why the Buddha didn't reserve this for graduate students is that it's kind of evident if we look carefully at our own experience. You know, it's an investigation that is accessible to us all. Whereas mana, or the conceit of self, I think is somewhat a little bit more elusive. it's a little bit more hidden, it's a little bit harder to put our finger on, and it's often more historical. Okay. So for a moment, looking at Sakaya Ditti, or personality view, it's like the question of how do you view yourself in this moment? It's almost a question of who you are just now. How would you describe yourself in this moment? I'm bored, I'm uncomfortable, I'm confused, I'm agitated, I want to be out of here, I want to stay forever, I feel good, I feel bad, I'm obsessing, I'm excited, I'm planning, I'm in pain. This is Sakaya Ditti. Okay, it's no more complicated than that. This is the personality view of the moment. Sometimes it's really intense, isn't it? You know, we hear the shout of a personality view. You know, we hear that bellow of I am. You know, particularly in discomfort. I am. Sometimes it's sort of like more like a quiet murmur or a quiet whisper that we hardly notice until we look more closely. But then I would invite you to cast your mind back just a few hours. Has your view of self changed? Have you seen any changes in that self-description over the day, over just a few hours? I'm happy, I'm sad. You know, I feel optimistic, I feel hopeless, you know. I feel like I'm understanding something. No, I feel like I'm totally confused. Now, cast your mind back even further in your life and remember all your views of self. Remember all the houses you have inhabited in your life. As a child, as a teenage rebel, you know, your first relationship. Do you remember your view of self? Do you remember your view of self in your first breakup? Do you remember your view of self as a student, as a parent, as a partner? These are all the changing faces of identity, the changing faces of view. And do you remember, too, sometimes how substantial those houses felt? You know, I'm going to feel like this forever. You know, this is who I am. I'm always going to be that teenage rebel. You know, I'm always going to be that radical. You know, I'm always going to be hopeless. You know, I'm always going to be in love. You know, how substantial at times those houses have felt. I'm always going to be forlorn. This is who I am. Now, the degree of substantiality of our houses is entirely related to the intensity of the clinging and the identification that is present. So sometimes we inhabit very flimsy shacks, and sometimes we inhabit moated castles. Now, sometimes we inhabit those flimsy shacks, you know, the wind blows through, the sun shines through. You know, it's these kind of moods, the mental states, the perceptions, that kind of arise as a sort of reaction, a clinging to something that's going on in the body, or an identification with a passing thought, or a passing mood. And then we see its foundations are quite weak, you know, and it changes, you know, it changes momentarily, you know, we can shift from one house to another. But sometimes there's just enough mindfulness to know it as a formation, as a construction, and it begins just to dissolve and to soften and doesn't really have much hold. But sometimes we are inhabiting fortresses, and these are the views of self that are far more historical, far more repetitive, far more familiar. You know, a couple of months ago, I was in a post office in the town where I live, and I was going up to the counter, to pay. And a young woman was coming from the other direction, also going up to the counter to pay. And the reality was, you know, she was ahead of me. So I just said to her, you know, please feel free, just go up and pay. And she looked at me with this kind of astonished look, and she said, "That's amazing." And I was puzzled, and I said, "Why is it amazing?" She says, "I am the kind of person people always bump in front of in queues." And quite frankly, my heart sank. And I thought, well, what is it like to go through life living in that house, that I am the kind of person that is actually so invisible or so worthless or whatever, that I am the kind of person people always push in front of in queues? It felt so terminal. You know, it felt like a kind of a life sentence. But that's probably not that unusual, perhaps. You know, maybe I'm the kind of person who always gets pushed around, you know, or maybe I'm the kind of person that nobody listens to, you know, or maybe I'm the kind of person that nobody really respects, you know. Maybe I'm the kind of person who's always going to be shy. Or I'm the kind of person who's never going to be happy. You know, I'm the kind of person who's never going to be loved or successful. If you notice the way that clinging and identification tends to intensify around what we can't accept, how it tends to intensify around what we fear or what we feel averse to. Sometimes clinging also intensifies around what we crave and feel we don't have. Now, these historical views, these historical personality views, these historical views of self, I think indeed they become patterns, they become tendencies, they become sankharas in themselves, almost like a default position. The Buddha proposed this sort of this bundle theory. It's a sort of bundle theory that the body is perceived as self, that part of this bundle is feeling is perceived as self, perception is perceived as self, volition is perceived as self, and consciousness is perceived as self. And I am the owner of all of this. Identification actually translates into ownership. I am the owner of all of this. This belongs to me. I am defined by all of this. This is who I am. Now, Pali, of course, some of you will know this very well, is a language of verbs. It's also a language of process. It's not a language of nouns. It's not a language of anything being static. And certainly from the perspective of the Buddha's teaching, selfing is a process. It is a verb. That in Buddhist psychology, there is a continuum that can be traced. That craving and aversion, unattended to and fed, intensify into clinging or identification. That clinging and identification intensifies into becoming, and becoming lands us in the house we are inhabiting, the I am, the view of the moment. So it's not as if identification and clinging are something separate from craving and aversion. It's not as if the view of who I am is somehow separate from the process of identifying. That this is a continuum. Craving and aversion, intensifying into clinging or identifying, identifying, intensifying into becoming, until we reach that arrival point of the view of I am. This is something really important to see and understand, because so often we separate and fragment these, you know, and we think, oh, well, identification is over here, craving aversion is over here, view is over there. These are all part of the same continuum. Only a magnification of the same continuum. Is that clear? Can you get a sense of that? Can you sort of track that in your own experience? This is a process of hammering it all together. You know, this is a process of assembling it all together until we reach that arrival place of our abode that we inhabit. Now, of course, with mindfulness, we're learning a lot of things. With mindfulness, we're learning, first of all, to be more present in this process, you know, because a lot of this is sort of energetic surges, isn't it? It's not kind of a cognitive process. It's more like an energetic surge, almost like a reflex, that the cognitive process is feeding into. But it is almost an energetic surge. And with mindfulness, we're learning to be a little bit more aware of this process. We learn we can calm the craving and aversion impulses. We learn we can build some pauses into the craving and aversion impulses. If we can learn how to calm the craving and aversion impulses, we're actually learning to calm the clinging and we're learning to calm the selfing. These are powerful tendencies. But their power, of course, is entirely reliant upon the absence of mindfulness and investigation. It's why I almost suggested to you in the walking period to look at those switches between mindfulness and heedlessness, between mindfulness and forgetfulness. Because these are all moments of forgetfulness. It is when impulse or habit, the habitual power of the patterns, have overtaken any dimension of mindfulness and then seem to have a momentum of their own. But they actually don't have a momentum of their own. They actually don't have a life of their own. Their momentum relies upon the absence of mindfulness and investigation, which we're learning to cultivate. And as we learn to cultivate more of that mindfulness and investigation, we begin actually to see a little bit more the transparency of some of these personality views. You know, we begin to see them as being a little bit more transparent, not quite so solid, not so much I am. And we begin to see that the view of self is not a noun. It's not an entity. It's not an essence. It's not stable. And it's clearly not independent. The I am is shaped by what is identified with. It doesn't exist independently of that. The I am is shaped by whatever is clung to in the moment. Therefore, I am my body, or I am my pain, I am the sufferer, you know, I am my mood, I'm happy, I'm sad. Whatever is identified with, this becomes the shape of who I am. So, selfing is a verb and a process, but what the introduction of identification and clinging does is that it turns process into state. It turns verb into noun. That is when we reach the view that says, I am. Okay, so the view of self is also shaped by the interaction with the other. The other is the world of events, the world of sensory impressions, the world of people. My body, my eyes, my nose, my tongue, and the sense door of my mind is constantly interacting with the world of sight, sounds, sensations, thoughts, tastes, smells. It's not only interacting with this world, we are reacting to the other. So some of the other in the world of sensory impression, including thoughts, we welcome, others we reject. Some we like and some we dislike. Some we fear and some we want. And if all of this is unseen, then those reactions, again, are magnified into clinging that shapes my view of self. I'm afraid of this. I hate this. I really want this. I really need this. Now, the view of self, I hope this is... the view of self also shapes the view of the other. So then we go through the life saying, that's good, that's bad, that's innately terrible, that's innately beautiful, this innately has the power to make me happy, this innately has the power to make me sad, you know, this innately has the power to excite me, this innately has the power to depress me. We have invested, what has been invested through clinging, is an independent self-existence in the other. Does that make sense to you? Mm-hmm. You're with me? Good. Now, the language is very difficult. English language is very, very difficult. Just the way we form our sentences is really difficult because it really suggests as if I'm doing all of this. You know, I need, I want, I'm getting rid of, you know, I'm cultivating, I'm letting go, you know. It really sounds all the time, doesn't it? The language structure just keeps solidifying this sense of autonomy in me. The cockpit, in the pilot in the cockpit is there, you know, somehow enacting all of this in some sort of autonomous way. In reality, of course, sight, sound, sensations happen. They appear. The world of conditions we've actually never been able to control, and we think we should be able to. But it is again, when we hear that those sentences, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, go back to Paul Brock's suggestion. Who reigns the reign? Who thunders the thunder? Do we not see this mandala, this interface of sensory impressions, including thoughts, interfacing with consciousness, shaping and reshaping? I'm not actually in charge of all of this. But this shaping and interfacing is taking place upon a certain ground. It's taking place upon the ground of confusion or the ground of understanding. And that ground is actually in our hands. I do not cling. I do not identify with things. Clinging and identification happens when craving and aversion are fed. I also do not let go. I'm really happily able to say at this point in my life, I have never let go of one single thing. Because how would I, who is that? This is the curiosity to me, you know, often that, you know, even though we can contemplate these changing views of personality views, still lurking behind it, there's this curious belief in autonomy, you know, that I've got this little self that's going to march forward at the appropriate moment and let go. Still, there's something there. But I do not let go. But actually, through sincerity, through dedication, through understanding, there is the cultivation of the conditions of stillness and calmness, investigation, in which letting go happens. And I really, really want you to check that out in your own experience. Because I don't think this is alien to anyone. You know, have you ever had the experience, you know, where you're sitting and you're pretty agitated or feeling pretty contracted, you know, or disturbed in some way, and a difficult thought or a difficult memory comes along, and doesn't it just stick? It's like the conditions are perfect for stickiness. And so you just feel it stick, and then you feel the clinging, the craving or the aversion, you feel the intensification of that into identification, into becoming. And you notice you may have another sitting or another period when the conditions of your heart and mind are so very, very different when there's greater spaciousness, greater stillness, greater calmness, exactly the same thought or the same memory arises, and it just passes right on through. It doesn't stick. What has changed is not the content. What has changed is the environment in which that content is appearing. What is in our hands, of course, is cultivating the conditions conducive to non-stickiness. Now, the Buddha put it that when no view of self is clung to, no view at all is clung to. In fact, suggested that the only thing that keeps anything at all fixed in place is our view of it. Which is kind of startling. But it's not so... It's pretty seeable. Think about someone you've met who annoys you in some way. Probably everyone can do that exercise without too much effort. Think of someone you've met who annoys you in some way. You know, maybe they've done something really innocuous. You know, maybe it's somebody here. They put their shoes in front of the door and you stumbled over them. And you know whose shoes they are. You know very well whose shoes they are. Because they always put their shoes in front of the door. Eh? And, you know, you only need to see that person, you know, 5 years later. There they are, the person who always puts their shoes in front of the door. We keep them fixed in place, for our view. That person may be radically transformed, you know, and sure, 1,001 things have changed in their life. You know, they may even no longer put their shoes in front of the door. But in our mind, our view has kept them fixed in place. We also do this to ourselves, by the way. And we do this too much in the world by investing that independent self-existence and innate powers in things, you know, of something is always going to be repulsive or ugly or terrible, or something is always going to be wonderful. That the Buddha proposed that when no view at all is clung to, this is the end of contractedness, this is the end of fear, this is the end of pursuit, this is the end of avoidance, this is peace, this is liberation. So the second way in which self is reified is through mana, or the conceit of self, which is a very awkward phrase. But it's the positioning of self. As relational beings, unfortunately, we also turn ourselves into comparing and evaluating beings in relationship to others. So one way the conceit of self manifests is I see myself to be somehow lesser, more inferior, less able, less confident, less adequate, less lovable, less perfect than you. The second way is that I actually see myself as being better than you. I see myself as being more elevated, more superior, more knowledgeable, more clever, you know, more perfect, more lovable than you are. Or, and the third way of this positioning, is that I see that we're all the same. We're, you know, everybody does this. Everybody's like this. We're all just kind of foolish, imperfect people, muddling our way through life, swimming in a sea of mediocrity, with very few possibilities, and we're all like this. Everyone's like this. Unable to change. Now, mana is often quite, well, a little bit more hidden, but it has such powerful impacts in our life, you know. It actually governs pretty much everything. Our choices, our speech, our sense of possibility, our sense of impossibility. It may determine where we sit in the hall. Am I, you know, seeing myself as lesser than you, somehow less worthy? I want to be invisible. You know, I sit where nobody sees me. I keep silent instead of speaking. I'm sure my question is too stupid to ask, you know. I make sure that I'm not exposed because I'm so afraid of criticism and judgment and blame that is going to reinforce that conceit of self that tells me, you know, how helpless I actually am. I may resign myself to impossibility. Sometimes the story of mana is told to us by others. You know, if you've grown up in a climate, an environment where you're constantly told of your inadequacy, your incompetence, your inability, you will soon internalize that view. If I see myself to be better than you, I'm going to be very busy protecting that. I'm going to be very busy making myself invulnerable. I'm going to be quite assertive. I may be very domineering, you know, I may be very commanding. I may be, you know, very opinionated. And I will look down on you and I will have very little room for compassion, very little room for empathy, very little room for kindness. If I feel myself to be the same as you, well, you know, I'm going to look for the lowest common denominator. I'm going to find it very hard to have anything to aspire to or to believe that anyone ever got awakened. You know, the Buddha was just a story. You know, nobody ever got awakened in this life. You know, nobody ever aspired for something different. And again, this is a story that can be told to us by others over and over and over again. It influences how we practice. You know, if I feel to be worse than you, imperfect, you know, I may just sit and feel, you know, like it's a really lucky accident if I run into a breath every now and then. You know, if I might feel myself to be really better than you, you know, I might very likely to be a striver. You know, and if I feel myself to be really inferior, I'm going to feel that, you know, the deepest goals of this path are somehow impossible for me. And mana is so interesting, you know, because it's so subtle. Sometimes it's just taking place in this ongoing comparing. This ongoing comparing, evaluating ourselves, how we position ourselves in relationship to others, what feels safe and what feels unsafe. You know, how we can be hidden or afraid, or how we can be, you know, very forful. It's so interesting the way this conceit of self kind of manifests. But for me, I think it's really these two, the mana, the conceit of self, which is often quite historical, actually. You know, I find that in this culture, most people tend towards inferiority conceit. You know, which is why, you know, so many people in this culture struggle so much with, you know, what gets labeled as the inner critic, the inner judge, you know, the voice of condemnation, the voice of blame. You know, I don't meet so many people who are, you know, burdened with superiority conceit. You know, it seems to be a lesser opportunity. But I think it's so important to see the way in which mana, the conceit of self, is also interacting with personality view, and way in which personality view keeps deepening those more underlying conceits, those more underlying beliefs of who I am, those historical ones. You know, we see that if I believe myself to be somehow inferior, and personality view is shaped around that, you know, it's going to be, you know, I'm going to find it difficult to be really generous to myself or others, you know, because that's going to feel like losing something. I'm going to be hyper alert, you know, I'm going to have a lot of self-consciousness. The sense of the inner critic is going to be all, you know, very highlighted. And so the personality view is shaped, and then the mana is deepened. But the more that I deepen that sense of inferiority, the more inclined I'm going to be to seek all of that invisibility, to perpetuate that self-criticism. So it's kind of an interfacing process. Huh? The personality view of the moment shaping, deepening the historical personality view, and the historical conceit of self being a setup for shaping the personality view of the moment. And so it sort of becomes this kind of closed feedback loop of self-consciousness, actually, of self-consciousness. What we actually do see is the way in which both personality view and mana really sabotage our greatest allies. And our greatest allies, actually, in this path are not just mindfulness and investigation. Our greatest allies in this path are actually the Brahma Viharas. The capacity to befriend, that boundless friendliness, the capacity for compassion, the capacity for joy, the capacity for equanimity. And actually, we see the way in which mana and personality view keep sabotaging those capacities. Because if I feel worse than you, how much capacity do I have to celebrate your well-being? If I feel to be inferior to you, how much capacity do I actually feel for empathy? Do I more see, you know, a sense of you know, I'm you're worse off. Sorry, this sounds awful, you know. Now you know what suffering really feels like. Now you know what misery really feels like, you know. If I really feel to be locked within a positional sense of superiority, I might have pity, but I might not have compassion. And if I feel locked into any of these views, my capacity for equanimity is severely hindered. And joy gets suffocated because I'm so busy defending, or I'm so busy asserting, I'm so busy being me. You know, and joy is never something we contrive. Joy is something we make room for. You know, and identification with personality view and with mana takes up an awful lot of space. There's not so much room for joy because there's so much busyness and agitation within it. So what is really, we might say, what is really the work of this path? It's not about annihilating the self. It's not about shouting at ourselves to let go. But it is really about cultivating that moment-to-moment spacious awareness in which the transparency of selfing can truly be seen, that allows the clinging to fade, that allows the craving and aversion impulses to fall away. You know, when the Buddha truly extolled the blessings and the virtues of homelessness, he wasn't just talking about taking up a monastic life and leaving the world. He was talking about the virtues and the freedom of bringing house building to an end, of bringing this constructing process of personality view to an end. In the Udana Sutta, it says, seclusion is happiness for one content who knows the Dhamma, who has seen. Friendship with the world is happiness for those restrained towards all beings. Dispassion amidst the world is happiness for those who have let go of sensual craving. But the end of the conceit of I am, this is the greatest happiness of all. This is the greatest happiness of all. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for your attention. I hope that was coherent.
It was.